Kataksha Kirana Chanta Naman Mohavdaye Namaha Anantananda Krishnaya Jagan Mangalamurtaye Ahamasmi Sada Bhami Kadachinahamapriyaha Pramayava Hamatasiddham Sachidananda Lakshanam Mayevo Deti Chidvyomni Jagadgandharva Pattanam Atohan Nakatam Brahma Sarvagyam Sarvakaranam Nasvatah Pratya Vijnana Niram Shatvan Nachanyataha Nachashri Vinashane Vinashasyat Anashriya Nashosha Plosha Vikleda Chedas Chinnapasomama Satyairapyanilagnyambaha Shastraikimutakopitaihi Abharupasya Vishwasya Bhanam Bhasam Dirvina Kadachinnapikalpeta Bachahantena Sarvagaha. I said that right, wrong, sorry. Let's do it again from the top. Abharupasya Vishwasya Bhanam Bhasam Dirvina Katachin Navakalpeta Bachahantena Sarvagaha Nahi Bhanat Rate Satvam Narate Bhanam Chito Chitaha Chitsan Bedho Pinadyasat Rate Tena Hamadvayaha Nadeho, now repeat after me. Nadeho Nindriyan Chaham Nadeho Nindriyan Chaham Naprano Namano Nadihi Naprano Namano Nadihi Mamata Pariraddhatvat Mamata Pariraddhatvat Akridatvat Idandhyaha Akridatvat Idandhyaha Na dehaha, na indriyam, cha aham, pranaha, na pranaha, na manaha, na dihi. Mamata pariraddhatvat, akridatvat, idam dihaha. Na dehaha, na indriyam, cha aham, aham, I. I am na dehaha, I am not the body, and I am not the indriyas. Indriyas, kind of the prana indriyas, the jnana indriyas, and the karma indriyas. The jnana indriyas are the sense organs, jnana indriya. Indriya is an organ, jnanam, knowledge, an organ of knowledge. So jnana indriya. The organs of knowledge, the sense organs, are the jnana indriyas. Then karma indriya, the organs of action. Karma indriya. So the karma indriyas are the organs of action, like your hands and your feet, the vak, your speech, your sexuality, your organ of excretion. These are the organs of action for your body. So, so I'm not this physical body. I'm not the deha. I'm not the sense organs or the organs of action. I am not the prana. The prana is the vital force, that which enlivens the body and gives, for instance, your digestive system and your circulatory system and your peristaltic system that allows you to eject the soul at the time of death, or any upward motion or any downward motion of excretion. All of these... this is all the energy, the prana that enlivens the body in all of these ways for all the operations of the body. So I'm not the prana. I'm not the vital force in the body. I'm not the manas. I'm not the mind. And I'm not the buddhi. So basically all of the all of the things that I identify with, all of the upadis, are being negated. We could add some more, but these the basic upadis are being negated as I am not that. And so what's the logic for my to be able to say I am not that? Mamata pariraddhatva. Pariraddha, this is different than prarabdha. Pariraddha. Pariraddhatva, because of being embraced. Pariraddha means to embrace something. Because all of these are being embraced by mamata, the sense of mine. Mama is mine. Mamata is that minus. This is my body. These are my sense organs. This is my thought. These are my, these are my emotions. These are my feelings. These are my sense organs, my organs of action. That's mamata, that sense of belonging. These belong to me. But something that belongs to me, something that is mine, is different than me. And so all of these things that I take to be myself, at the same time that I take them to be myself, I talk about them as belonging to me. That's one thing. Then he says, that's one. Mamata pariraddhatvat. Then akriditvat idandiyaha. Akriditvat. What's wrong? You don't have the
verb? No, I just realized there's two of them here.
Oh.
One of them got put down on top of my thing, so I have somebody else's.
Who's missing one?
So
Jackie's missing one.
I made a couple of marks on it, so.
That's actually Lisa's, and Lisa has Jackie's.
Okay.
Does yours have any marks on it?
No.
No problem. Okay. It's okay. You stole the cycle. I'm joking. Akrita twat idandiyaha. So, akrita means play. Okay. So there's a play space, like Winnicott, a great psychologist, talks about this internal play space, you know, for a normal person. And a person who has a personality disorder or something often doesn't have any internal play space, where something is objectified and tossed around and played with. So idam means this. So there's this play space because of being having a play, the play space of this. So like with this body, this my body is so fat, or my body is thin, or my body is tall, or my body is tired, or my mind, this mind of mine, that's the plan, this mind of mine is behaving in such and such a way. My emotions, these emotions are acting like such and such and such and such. So there is a play space between me and my perceptions, and my perceptions of the what, of those things which get the ahambuddhi, the ahambriti, the ahankara, the things which get the ahankara. The ahankara means I just assume I am this. I am this body. Without any even thinking, but then I respond to this body as mine, not as me. Right? This is my body. And I also am always commenting on this body. So when you say that play space, it means there is a space between me and what I'm perceiving. In order to, I find myself naturally, of course we don't analyze this, except when we get to Vedanta usually, we don't analyze it, that I am always responding, aware of this body, what the body is doing, how this body is feeling. Right? So that means it's always just naturally an object of my awareness. We don't think about it, that's all. But we're always responding to it as an object of my awareness. And the same is true for all the emotions in your mind, right? These are my... I am sad, okay? That's a total identification. That adhyasa is complete. I am a sad person. Okay, so my being is sad. I am sad. But then I can also say, I can be aware of the sadness, you know. And I said, I'm feeling so sad. Today I'm feeling sad, you know. Or I recognize I am objectifying the sadness, you know, and noticing how sad I am. But you experience the sadness, you comment on the sadness, the commentation on the sadness belongs to me, not somebody else. And so there's much more going on in my experience of my body, mind, sense organs, the upadis, much more than just simple identity. And there should be much more than simple identity, because we have a subject-object relationship with it. And so with my upadis, there's the possessiveness. It's my body and not your body. This is mine. It's my mind. It's not your mind. There's the possessiveness, the ownership of these upadis. Upadis means anything that gets the eye. If I say, I am this body, the body becomes an upadi, sometimes translated as conditioning adjunct, right? And so these experiences all are my experiences. The upadis all belong to me. Not only that, I have subject-object relationship with them. The aham buddhi, me, the conscious being, the me, the self, myself, you know, and this mind. This is my mind. This is my body. This means objectification. I wouldn't say use the word this or think of the word this in reference to me. In reference to me. I use the word this in reference to those things which are closest to me. Things that are farther away, I use the word that. So this is a pronoun for those things which are close to me, in my proximity. You know, I see this, I hear this. Yeah. So when we do the prakriya, the teaching methodology of drisha viveka, what is happening is that these upadis, through the recognition of subject-object, recognition that I am aware of them as an object, that I have a subject-object relationship with them, what happens is that all of the upadis gain the same stature as the rest of the world. As the rest of the world. Because say I have a subject-object relationship with everything external to my body. Say I say, I see all of these things. I'm aware of the world that's right in front of me. Through sense perception, I'm aware of this world. I have a subject-object relation with it. Normally when we're talking like that, I'm aware of all of this. I'm not saying, and all of these are objectified, these are all objects, subject-object. I don't then go on to say, and I have the same relationship with my body. I don't usually go on to say that, because I've just so taken for granted even the language that I am this body, mind, sense organs, and everything else external to it, it gets the idamvriti. This goes here, right? Anything external to the body. But the body doesn't get the pronoun this. And so, in chapter 13 of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna makes a division between the kshetra and the kshetrajna. The word kshetra means field. A field, like a field. Kshetrajna is the knower of the field. Okay? But what he's meaning by the field of experience is only the physical body. He's only talking about the physical body. And then Shankara says, why is Krishna, when using the word field, the field of experience, only in relationship to the physical body, you know, and within? And he says, well, that's because we all know that the rest of it is a field. The rest of this is a field. He doesn't have to tell you, you know, that you have a subject-object relationship with the field of experience. You have to know that you have a subject object relationship with the field of experience, which is this body and inward. And so the idam vritti, this, I see this, I'm aware of this, I know this, this is an object of my awareness, has to now include this physical body. Because your physical body is known to you through your sense perception, right? It's known to you through your sense, that the sense organs are your doorway to the perception of this physical body. Just like it's the sense organs that are the doorway to the perception of the world. This body and that body and that body and all bodies are objectified and belong and are part of Ishwara. They belong to the world. So that idam vritti, the idam vritti, the this vritti, has to now extend inward to include my body, because my body is as much an object of perception as the rest of the world. Once I realize that, then this body, in a sense, sometimes Swamiji would say, and I'll say, okay, so now understanding that, just realize it just for a moment. Like, for instance, if I were not to have any sight, it's not like I would still be seeing my body, right? If I lose my eyes, I don't see any of this, and I also don't see my body. If I lose my sense of hearing, I don't hear this, I don't also hear any sounds that my body is making. So if you go down all of the through all of the sense organs, you realize my relationship with this body is through sense perception, even the sense of touch, which runs through the entire body. Mm-hmm. So that's probably one that gives me the most identification, but it still is sense perception. And so the idam vritti is something which I experience all of the time, and I even talk as though I experience it all the time, but I don't understand the implications of it, that all of this is an object of awareness, and so is this, in exactly the same way, through sense perception. I talk about it like that, but and I respond to my body like that, but I don't understand what that means, that it doesn't click in. Okay? Also, the same with the mamata. This is my body, you know. It's not your body, this body belongs to me, it's mine. That also, I'm talking about the reality, in a sense, the reality, you know, of a subject-object relationship there. And so he goes through all of the different sense organs. The next one is the indriyas, you know. The indriyas, your sense organs, are aware of the body, but your mind is aware of the sense organs. Right? The sense organs are also objectified, or you wouldn't know whether they're working or not. You know, if you're losing your sense of hearing, it's not that you don't know that. You're aware of the sense organs, subject-object. There's, if you can be aware of the sense organs, and sometimes you're not aware of the sense organs. That's another thing. You're aware of the sense organs because of the mind, right? The mind focuses on the sense organs and comments on them, whether they're working or not. But what about when the mind is daydreaming? The mind is daydreaming, the sense organs are there, but they're totally inactive. They're there and they work fine, they're instruments, but they're not being used because your mind is often running in a daydream, right? So that means I'm certainly not these instruments that much of the time are not being utilized at all, because I'm lost in my mind. I'm projecting into the future and worried about the past, and, you know, lost in my imaginal thinking, and, you know, that's where I am. I'm not with the body. I'm not with the sense organs. So these are actual real life experiences. This isn't some sort of a theoretical. This is not theoretical. This is something to realize, to see the truth of it. Things that become objects to me. There's another thing. So say he goes to the sense organs, then we go into the manas. The manas contains all negative emotions and all fluctuating thought. That's what belongs to the manas. It's the thought flow, the indeterminate thinking, just the associative thinking, and also negative emotions we put there. So those also, you can never say that you're not aware of them. You're so aware of them. You know? I'm feeling so down, or I'm feeling so, you know, agitated, or I'm so worried, or I'm so unhappy, or whatever it is. You know, I'm so antsy. And so Swamiji will go like this, how do you know you're antsy? How do you know? Are you saying that? How do you know that? Yeah. I know, of course I know. I'm very aware of it, you know. Because we are, you know. So the all of the emotional states also are objectified by me, and I can comment on them. And as with every other experience I have, I can watch them come and go. That's huge. That anything that I can watch come and go, any experience, is not me. There's the, we have to learn how to, even without saying it, kind of naturally apply that anvaya vyatireka. When this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. Then there's a relationship. But when this is, that is, and when this is not, that still is, there's no relationship. Right, so an emotion comes, an unhappy emotion comes, I can say, you know, the unhappy emotion comes, I am unhappy. Right? The unhappy emotion goes, I go. So the unhappy emotion is, I am. Relationship. The unhappy emotion is there, I am there. Potential identification, okay? But the unhappy emotion goes, and I still am. No relationship. Because that state of experience, if that state of experience can go, and I still am, where's the relationship? I have the experience, but there's no relationship. It means I am what we call asanga. My being is unattached completely to that experience because it can go and I still am. That's the anvaya vyatireka. Every thought is like that. Every experience is like that. This experience is there. I have this experience. I am there. Experience is there. I am there. Experience is gone. I'm still there. That is the reality. That's the whole satya mitya. You think of any experience. Experience means an objectifiable. Any objectifiable experience, is it bound by time? If you say yes, then we're not going to have any proper anvaya vyatireka. If it's bound by time, it's going to move on, either quickly or slowly. If it moves on, then that experience, I am a sangha. I have no attachment to that experience. It is not stuck to me in any way. As I understand that, there's a viveka, a discrimination that needs to take place. When we use the word viveka, the whole Vedanta really, in a sense, rests on this, what we call viveka jnanam. Viveka means discrimination between two things that are appearing to be one. Two things appearing to be one. The example that is often like in Atmabodha and Tathagata and all of these texts, the very, very common example they use for that is the red hot iron ball. Use it over and over, and it'll come up as a drishtanta, so many texts. Because unless you know fire and you know iron, if you see a red hot iron ball, there's not necessarily any viveka there. It's that the heat and the bright redness and the weight and the roundness are all qualities of one substance. Right? So red, hot, iron, ball are just what the thing is. Right? So there's no viveka. To have viveka of these two things that appear as one, you have to be able to separate the fire from the iron. This is fire, this is iron. Fire is more pervasive, you know, more subtle, more pervasive than earth. So the fire is able to pervade the iron so that they appear as though one. That has to be understood. And so then when you see a red hot iron ball, you don't think there's just one entity there. But it's natural to think that there's one entity there if that viveka jnanam, that discriminative knowledge, is not taking place. There's the story also of the Hamsa bird. The Hamsa bird goes to a bird bath sits at the edge of a bird bath that is filled with milk and water, a mixture of milk and water. The humpsuck bird puts its beak in and sucks out all the milk. That's the viveka. Two things really appearing as one. Can I sit down? Okay. Two things really appearing as one that are actually two. And why they use this, the milk and water, is because it's very difficult. Very difficult to discern which is which. And here for us, in reference to conscious being, the consciousness, and my body, mind, sense organs, and the upadhi, very difficult to make that discernment, because satya mitya. What satya mitya means, what you doing? You want to get down here? Oh, yeah. With the satya mitya, mitya has no being of its own. So look at the difficulty between making a discern, in using our good old clay pot, to have to discern between the clay and the pot. What kind of a discernment is that? It's a really interesting, because it's not as though the pot is not clay. The pot is clay. So how is the pot to recognize its relationship to the clay when it is the clay? So in understanding the satya mitya, it's the recognizing that the pot recognizing, you know, I depend on the clay for my being, but the clay doesn't depend on me, and in fact, from the standpoint of clay, I'm not even there. There is only me there. That's the viveka that we're being asked to make. This whole creation depends upon me, like the pot depends upon the clay. And so for the mind, body, sense organs to make a discernment between myself, between itself and myself, is not an easy thing, because really there is only myself. You see, like, try to find the pot. You know, the pot is there, it's being experienced, but can you find the pot as something separate from the clay? So say the pot's on that search to find the clay, to have viveka. The pot wants viveka jnanam. It wants discriminative knowledge between itself and the clay. That's pretty tough, you know. Now look at your situation. Your mind, so you have to remember, just try to go back to being completely ignorant, which is not possible to do, right? Ask you to do that anyway. Because once you know you can't get the self-ignorance back. But anyway, this is the problem. The mind very correctly recognizes itself as the Satchit Ananda. As such, it recognizes, we'll leave the Ananda for a while, because Ananda we always think of it as bliss, and that doesn't work. So we won't leave that for now. The mind always takes itself to be conscious being. I am the conscious being. I am a conscious being. Okay, so I am a conscious being. I, the mind, am a conscious being. No. Now, what part of the mind is not a conscious being? There is no part of the mind that is not a conscious being, right? Does it have like an inert wall around it or something? I, the mind, you know, have this little conscious being inside of it? No. The whole mind is the conscious being. You might as well say, which is as true, the whole mind is Brahman. Every single part of the mind is Brahman. Every single part of the body is Brahman. The sukshma sharira, the subtle body, goes through the physical body. So the physical body, even though in the sukshma, the subtle body travels, this is left as just earth and elements, and it goes back into the elements. But as long as it's enlivened by the subtle body, it is pervaded by consciousness. The Sukshma Sharira pervades the physical body all the way through. So the whole physical body enjoys conscious being. Now the question is, what part of the physical body does not enjoy conscious being? As long as it's whole, as long as it's intact. You say, well, no part. Because the Sukshma Sharira pervades the whole thing. Now we're just talking about Sukshma Sharira. It pervades the whole thing. You say, yeah, but there's the subtle pervading the gross. That's true. The subtle is pervading the gross from within Maya. From within Maya. That's the tricky part right there. Subtle is pervading the gross from within Maya. And then the Atma, right, is the very self of the mind, is the very self of the subtle, of the subtle body. But now the problem is that Maya itself has no independent being. To the same degree that the pot has no independent being. It's just why you can get confused around this is the body, this body is made of parts, right? And so if you think, well, yeah, but the substance of this body, what fills this body is muscle and bone, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. As though that is real. As though that really has substance. So they take the contours of the body, what's filling this form, muscle, bone, et cetera. Okay. And so that becomes the material cause of the body. But then you have to go into, well, what is muscle? And then you go into cells, et cetera. What are cells? And you go into them. In the end result, there are names within names within names within names within names of what substance? I'm going to sort of say forms within forms within forms within forms of what substance? Conscious being. You have to take the form off. What's inside the form? What's inside the form has got to be formless, or you're just labeling the form with littler forms. But once you get down to that point, say you've broken these forms, it's gone crazy, breaking the forms into smaller forms and smaller forms and smaller forms in search of ultimately the substance, you end up with what you think is the smallest form, and then you have to get to the substance of that, and that one is the relationship in the end is clay pot, where the substance of the form, right, is the very being, the reality of the form. And what is the truth of the form? Mithya. There is no truth to the form. There is no form. There is no form other than... nothing is filling that form other than Brahman. And so just like the poor pot trying to figure out its relationship to the clay, trying to give some sort of separate reality to itself, and it can't do that, you know. It can only say, I am the clay. We're in that situation. I am the conscious being. It's absolutely correct. I am the conscious being. And so now we have to make a differentiation, though, to recognize that, yes, I am the conscious being, but the conscious being is not me. In the sense that I, the nama-rupa, the names and forms, my body, the upadis, depend upon me, the conscious being. I am its being, but the being that I am is a different order of reality. It's a different order of reality. It is not contained in any way by the nama-rupa. The nama-rupa is mithya. Name and form is mithya. It has no relationship with the maya other than being its adhishtana. That's why adhishtana here is an important word. The adhishtana is that on which the mithya depends. So the Brahman is the adhishtana, what is actually here. Me, the conscious being, is what is actually here. And the body, mind, sense organs, anything we call an upadi, anything that can take the eye, is in fact Brahman. Right? It is in fact Brahman. And then we're asking you to differentiate the mind, to differentiate itself from itself. Right? Itself, the mind, the nama-rupa, from the self, which in fact it is. So
this is a very furry self.
He's trying to find his rightful place in the situation. Yeah, he wants to find a way to sit down. Yeah. There we go. Good boy, Lincoln. He found his place. This is the same as at the ashram. He always wanted to be in the class. People wouldn't just let him come and be in the class. He would always try to come and try to find his place. Yeah. He's a Mamokshu dog. That's why he's with us. To always go to temple. She'd sleep at the temple every night. And they tried to run him out, and he'd sneak back in, sleep at the temple. He'd come to all the classes. He's a good boy. So,
he feels safe.
Mm-hmm. So this is, I'm just trying to kind of help you to kind of sit with the extraordinary situation that we are in, and why it is so difficult to make that viveka, that differentiation, because I already am that, and I am already identified with myself as Brahman because that's who I am. So I don't take myself to be anything else. It's just that from the standpoint of the mind and all of the upadis which are that, of course, take themselves to be that. It's like saying the pot, which is the clay, takes itself to be the clay. So that's why this satya-mitya relationship is so amazing. Yeah. And so what we have to do, where kind of the Achilles heel is in the whole thing, is that I can, what are you doing?
Oh, I'm cold because I'm wearing wet suits, so I'm just going to go change and come back.
Okay, yeah, be careful. Be careful with it. here's the Achilles heel to how we can possibly understand our situation. We have the ability to have it within this universe to have a subject-object relationship. You know, all of my sense organs are means of knowledge to objectify something. That is true, and we can do that and do it all the time. But I also have the ability to objectify those sense organs which objectify objects, right? I can do that. We know how to do that. I can guide you into that little exercise, and you can definitely do it, right? And then you can recognize even the relationship between the buddhi, kind of the decisive mind, and the fluctuating mind. And that's where all of this inner friend and dialogue comes in, is in that differentiation. I can see that. We're still totally in mitya, but we have this capacity for subject-object relationship. What happens as we go more and more subtle, we get to the body, the sense organs, the prana, which is inward, and then we get to the manas, the mind, and then we get to the buddhi. And then we can even get to the ahankara, which again is a type of thought, like I'm even aware of the I thought. All of a sudden, we have objectified all of the upadis, and it's the mind that's doing all of this. Yeah? We have objectified all of the upadis, the conditioning adjuncts, including the buddhi, and then we have to recognize that the buddhi and even the inner farthest that you can go in that subject-object objectification, even that innermost buddhi is itself objectified. Everything about you that you have taken to be yourself, you recognize is objectified. Then who are you? There's still a subject-object relationship there, right? Because the buddhi is known, right? And you can watch it change. And it can come and it can go, right? You watch it all changing, and you abide there as the sakshi, initially as the sakshi, as the witness. That's just your experience. But then as we analyze that experience, what you realize is that what you're calling the sakshi is not really a sakshi. What you're calling the witness is not really a witness, because all of the instruments that you use for that knower-known relationship have been objectified. You know, the buddhi, the mind is used for objectification of the sense organs, etc., and whatever thoughts and moods and emotions and all of that. The sense organs are used for the objectification of the world. Those are all objectified. Now, what if I remove all of them? What if I give all of them over to Ishvara? I give all of them to Ishvara because they all belong to the creation as things which are known to me. Then I'm just left with me. And what kind of a means of knowledge do I have available to me? What do I have available to me? Who am I? I'm just a conscious being. I am the very knownness because of which all these things are known. I've taken away all of the duality in this process of objectification. You know? There is nothing left to divide me from myself, or to even divide me from you, because you've all done the same thing. And now you're just left there with me, your own self, conscious being. You recognize everything else as something that exists within time, that you have a subject-object relationship, except now the ultimate subject is not a knower, it is consciousness, period. Because all of the instruments have been given over to the world of objectification, which is the world of Ishvara. It's been given over to Ishvara. And so the next step from there is, okay, I'm just a conscious being, but am I a little bubble of conscious being and you're a little bubble of conscious being? You know? We have to say, no, you know why? Because anything that I can objectify, I'm not. So even the space that would divide these bubbles is objectified. Consciousness itself is not objectified. So there's only one conscious being, which is the very self of all the me, right? Because you're still left as me, but you've taken off all of these dresses, that when the dresses are there, they're me, right? Because I am the self of those dresses. And so the me is always there. So seeing through the lens of all of these dresses of the buddhi and the manas and the manas and the sense organs and the body, you know, and the prana, seeing through those dresses, then I'll say, the vital force will say, yeah, I have so much energy today, you know, or this is me, this is how I'm feeling today, you know. I'm talking about me, you know. But this is the anyonya adhyasa, where the me that I am now, from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, is taking on all of the qualities of the body, mind, sense organs. And from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, not from the standpoint of consciousness. And then it's also taking consciousness to belong to itself. So this is the tricky situation. In Katha Upanishad, they talk about it as walking on a razor's edge. You know, because, you know, where's the line of separation? Because one thing is mithya, it has no being to be separated from consciousness. There's no gap, there's no line there. So of course you take yourself to be, the body, mind, sense organs takes itself to be the conscious being, and you look for the big self, Brahman. Because you are so much the conscious being, but there's such a thing as Brahman. Right? You would not even imagine that you are not the conscious being, but because you, the mind, body, mind, sense organs, are the conscious being, and they're talking about Brahman, then I, this conscious being, needs to have an experience of Brahman because of this razor's edge. You know, the identification is complete because there is really no separation between the upadhi and the self, because the upadhi is mithya. It has no, mithya means it's 100% dependent for its being upon the adhishtana, the self that it depends upon. So it's a very tricky thing in a way. you do this subject-object differentiation, the Drichtersche Vedanta. It seems so obvious in a way. But in the end, you know, in the end, to recognize that you're the being that you're left with, the being that you're left with, which is you, is the you that you have always been, you know, that you've always been, is a huge realization, because the tendency at this point is now to try for this little self to blend in with the big self somehow. Because it couldn't be me. Mm-hmm. Brahman couldn't be me. You know, because I'm this. So we have to, Swami talks about it sometimes in this Viveka Jnanam, you have to be like, have this, the teacher, or the pramana, he's like this torchlight, this floodlight, that's shining, chasing the ahankara. Mm. It's chasing the I notion, you know? And the I notion is always a step ahead. It's running, scrambling, you know? But the torch keeps going and going and going and going and going, and finally, the ahankara has no place to hide. And then it gives up. It says, okay, I am Brahman. And I am Brahman, no problem, you know? Because it's afraid it's going to die. Right? Because the identification with the upadhi is so much that it feels like the me, who I am, is going to be annihilated. That's how much the identification is. It feels that its very self is at stake, because the ajnana, the anyonya adhyasa, is so strong. The superimposition is so strong. That is the reality for beginningless lifetimes. It's not like just this lifetime. It's beginningless lifetimes. The identification of me with the upadhi is... It could not be stronger. And so that there is kind of a, you know, it's a chase. But when the and that's why, you know, there's in the teaching, Swamiji once said, like, teaching Advaita Vedanta is like an elephant dancing on a post. Because what needs to be said is, you are that, basically, you know. But we have to say it in 1,000 different ways. It has to be said in 1,000 different ways, because the mind, the ahankara, finds all these little corners to hide out in. And so you have to go to that corner and kind of blow it up a little bit, you know. You have to expose that corner. And then I'll hit there another corner, you have to expose that corner. Through language, through pointing out. So this prakriya is the Drichtersche Viveka prakriya that they're doing in this verse. He gives, really, in terms of what is the teaching methodology, the recognizing of the idamvritti, that subject-object relationship, and the mamata. This is mine. I'm already doing it. I'm already having that subject-object relationship. I just don't recognize it. So now we bring that subject-object relationship into a high degree of focus. And that's what we call the viveka. Viveka means discriminative knowledge. Viveka is a really important word that comes up in Vedanta, because the teaching methodology is around that. Let's do our prayer. Okay. Om Purnamidah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harih Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harih Om.
really a distinctive moment where the Ahamkara, you know, that the Ahamkara really has, like you just said, where it joins that greater awareness. You know, is that a distinctive moment actually that you can recognize, or is it more like conceptual what you're describing?
I actually think it's a pretty distinctive moment, though you can have many, many such moments. But what takes, I think, more one that's something that when the Ahamkara, instead of, you know, landing on the upadi as me, lands on the self, and that viveka, that's a very kind of beautiful, beautiful moment. It's like the big aha moment. Okay, but it takes time. More time and more maturing for that vairagya to set in reference to the world of experience, because this body, the identification, the habitual ignorance and behavior around this body in reference to my raga dvesha, in reference to my likes and dislikes, you know, in reference to all of my needs, in reference to feeling I have to make it through this life and to become successful or to whatever it is that I want to achieve, and worried about whether Ishwara is going to help me out here, and that's right. All of this kind of stuff, that takes time. The mind has to settle in reference to this knowledge, and as it settles and relaxes, then my own nature becomes more dominant in the mind. So the mind gains more and more shanti, right? Because it relaxes more and more and more into just being with myself and experiencing the world. The more I'm just like to be with myself and experience the world, the more everything is Ishwara. You know, and so this ahankara, or trying, having to make it, you know, or having to get the things that will make me happy and get rid of the things that won't, all of that takes some time to drop off. And it drops off to the degree that your mind is really enjoying some shanti and sense of well-being. So as the mind relaxes in the light of this knowledge, the more shanti the mind itself is enjoying, and then there's the differentiation of my own being from the shanti in the mind all of a sudden. There's a lot of growth that takes place, that takes some time. You know, even to see it, if the vision is just not I am Brahman, it's I am Ishwara. If I can say I am Ishwara, then I can say I am Brahman. It's perfect, because you know that this creation, which is Ishwara, is really Brahman. Brahman is its very self, is what is actually here. But you have to be able to say I am Ishwara. And sometimes in the West, students would want to say, I know I'm just Swamiji. They say, I know I'm Brahman, but we do really have to believe in Ishwara. You know, it's like saying, you know, I understand I'm Brahman, but I don't want to have to believe in God, Swamiji. Because the Western God image is really so bad, has so problematic in so many ways, that many people have just rejected the whole thing, and they don't want to have to bring it back either. That's why, even, you know, and I've talked before where I'm teaching this at school, CIS, I teach this class in Eastern Theories. It's called Eastern Theories of Self, Mind, and Nature. And the whole first part of the class has to do with differentiating, to understanding what exactly is your Western God image. What do you think God is? And why you don't like him. Yeah. Or you like him or don't like him. But what is it? What is that God that you're liking or not liking or accepting or feeling held by? Because if you don't do that, then Ishwara is going to just take the word, have the word God with all of its baggage superimposed onto Ishwara. And then, of course, you don't like Ishwara either. Yeah, because Ishwara is God. So a person need not know that there are many different God images, like it depends upon the religion, how they're defining God. So you're actually an atheist toward the God that you grew up with. And you may not be an atheist toward the God of another, of Vedanta, of Ishwara, because it then may totally resonate with you. But to even get a person, some Westerners, to even get near that, they're very, very hesitant, and they want to just dismiss. They don't want to have to go there. But then that knowledge isn't complete, you know, because this upadhi still has to make its way through the world somehow. I have to make my way. Prarabdha karma, none of those things will be real for you if there's no Ishwara. How can you relax into a creation with a little God up in heaven watching you critically? You know, that's much different than the whole creation coming from your being, being a manifestation of you. It's not a foreign object. It's a manifestation of the Atma, of yourself. It's not somebody else. But this body-mind-sense organs that we have, that ahankara, you know, that identification with, is a part to the whole, and I don't even know that. I am a limited being in this inert world, carving my way through, trying to make meaning out of my life and making something out of myself. That's what it's my mission. Trying to get some modicum of happiness and security from this world. And then I'll pray to some God in heaven to please bless me and help me, or just say the whole thing is bunk. Like Bill Maher, this whole thing is so stupid. It's ridiculous. How can people believe in such a thing? He's kind of right, because when he's looking at what the beliefs are, they are really damaging a belief system, usually. Yeah. But anyway.
That chase that you described, the torch, is, I find such an apt image, thinking, well, identify an object, sense awareness, that's the known, so this is sort of like chasing the light, but it's still another bit of that play space. Still know this object-object relationship. It's the only thing that might spin.
Yeah, and it will spin too.
Yeah.
Until it can't anymore. Until it gives up. And that's a very beautiful moment. Because it doesn't die.
But Swamiji once said that the ahankara has to recognize that it's in its own best interest not to keep on rising up.
Yeah.
And then,
yes.
Then when it does fully understand it,
then it'll lay down,
yes.
Like in the Dakshinamurti that has the apasmara underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And that apasmara, this ego, you know, the kind of mischievous ego, looks so happy. It's like this. And Bhagwan is his foot up. Okay. But when Swamiji's talking that way, he's talking something that I think is really, there's a little twist I want to put on that he's talking about, and that is, it is in my best interest in terms of my mind, for instance, so that there's that ahankara there. It's my best interest, you know, to just, to let Ishwara be and just be with myself. I have to discover that over and over and over again. The fight is not worth it. The raga dvesha, not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
It causes so much ashanti. It causes agitation and frustration and dislike, and all of these emotions are generated by that. What for? When I am the ananda that I'm seeking. And so the ahankara, buddhi, ahankara, goes on and on discovering the truth of that. So I think that's what really Swamiji is talking about, and that's a process that takes over in time. But in the teaching, when we're talking about this spotlight, that we can use that for that too. But the ahankara is hiding out in ajnanam. It's running around, hiding out in little dark corners, you know, where it can still be, you know, the body, mind, sense organs, limited little person. You know, and but the spotlight, because of the tradition of teaching, how thorough it is, the spotlight will go there, you know, and it'll scramble like, and it's like trying to catch a mouse in the house, you know. They're so fast, They're so fast, and as soon as you think you're going to put a little, like I have a little, like a, what is it, those little container that I'll put on the top and slide something under, so I'm all ready to get it, and it's, I almost get it, it's out. That's how the ahankara is. You know? But eventually, it doesn't have any corners left to be lit up, so it dissipates. And that then there's habitual ajnana of the habits of trying to get the.
Would you say a lot of times that hiding out is it's like unresolved things that, you know? I mean,
yeah, there's all unconscious unresolved things and conscious unresolved things. In other words, unresolved means I still think I need that for my ananda. We've done some recently, some meditations a little bit on this recently, where for in terms of vairagya, maybe the most powerful vairagya is when I have it toward my own mind. Mm-hmm. That I don't require my mind to have shanti or to be problem free or to be anything. If it's there, whatever is there, that's fine. It's mitya, it's fine. It doesn't cover me. And I can be with it, I can welcome it and take care of it. I'm happy to take care of it. Just like in the world, vairagya means this is the situation, I'm happy to do my part in it. That's vairagya. It's not getting rid of the situation, it's welcoming it, okay, I can, this is fine, let me be with this, let me handle that, it's fine. When it goes away, that's fine, it's time for it to go. That's vairagya. So what if you can apply that to your own psyche? This upset is there, this pain is there, this hurt is there, okay, that's okay, let me take care of you. You know. Because if, to the degree that we can put it positively, to the degree that we're able to do that, then to that degree the world is not threatening to us. Because the world is only threatening to us because it's going to cause my mind to take on reactionary conditions. And so I don't want those type of people or situations to come around me because they're going to create all these bad thoughts in me that I don't want these bad thoughts, these bad emotions. That's all dvesha. This bad emotion is going to come, you know. But what if I'm not afraid of my mind, you know, and I'm able to be with this? It's all mitya. It's like I can watch scary movies, you know. So I can be with these emotions in a way that dissipates them really. It dissipates means they just, instead of being like this, they just, you know, relax. Because I'm giving them love and not pushing them away. We don't like to be pushed away. Mm. We don't like it in external reality, we don't like it in internal reality. We don't like to be rejected or pushed away or and not paid attention to. It's very painful. And so I think we should stop now, if you don't mind. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Harih Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harih Om.